Our trip to Memphis on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe begins, as it should, at 926 East Macklemore Avenue, the home now of the Stax Museum, and in the 60s and 70s, the home of Stax Records, where Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Booker T and the MGs, Carla Thomas, and many others recorded soul hits. First up is a conversation with Isaac Hayes. Originally, Isaac was a studio musician at Stax, and then he and his songwriting partner Dave Porter started writing hits for other artists like Hold On, I'm Coming and Soul Man for Sam and Dave. Isaac went on to become a huge star in his own, parting ways with Stax in 1975 because of a dispute over royalties. He passed away in 2008. We talked with him in 2003 when I started out by asking him how he got started at Stax.
Oh, look, I came here several times trying to get inside, auditioning. And each time Jim Stewart said, well, fellas, I don't think that's what we're looking for. I came with a doo-wop groups. I came with a blues band. I came with a gospel group. And, you know, I didn't get inside until I joined Floyd Newman's band as a keyboardist. And Floyd Newman's one of the staff musicians here playing baritone saxophone. And Jim Stewart eased up to me one day and said, young man, Booker T is off in Indiana, you in school. Booker T and MGs, he said. So we need a keyboard player. Would you like the job? You kidding? Yeah. So I was brought on as a staff member. I was so excited. Oh, my God. And the staff was integrated. That was unheard of during those days.
Talk a little bit about that, because obviously, you know, the Stewarts who owned the place were white, but it seemed to be a really great mix. I mean, if you look at Booker T and the MGs, you get the idea.
That's right. You know, Jim Stewart, that's where the word Stax came from. His sister, Estelle Axton, Stewart and Axton. So it came with the name Stax. Perfect. We all mixed, man. And we were a family. We were a family. And that's it's a testament of the power of artistry, because it has no boundaries. You know, music has no boundaries. And it's a healing process, and that's what brought us together.
Now, I'm looking through the complete singles, the Stax box set, and the first one I see you getting a writing credit on is a Booker T tune called Bootleg. Is that accurate?
Yeah. You know, Booker came to me, said, Isaac, he said, you know, Paul McCartney, one of his favorite tunes is Bootleg. Hmm. He said, I'm going to have to tell people, because BBC is going to interview him. And he said, he's going to have to tell him that I didn't write that. Isaac Hayes did. He played on the record. So, you know, but that's very ethical of Booker to do that. But, you know, we did what we had to do to get everything done. You know, I mean, David Porter used to sing with Booker T and MGs. He was our vocalist. And one time I pretended to be Booker T because they got some dates mixed up, you know, bookings. And Booker went somewhere in Kansas, I think. And the MGs, we had to go to Pennsylvania. And I'm up there on organ. And the guys, people out there said, hey, no, Booker T, you ain't got no hair. I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do? And I jumped up and started doing some routines with Davey.
That's funny.
Oh, yeah. But one thing we did, what we had to do to get the job done.
Right. Well, of course, the big partnership for you is with David Porter. And the first Sam and Dave single you all wrote together was I Take What I Want.
Yeah, I Take What I Want. And the third writer on that was a guy named Teeny Hodges, who worked out of High Studio with Willie Mitchell.
Right.
And that was Teeny playing guitar on Loving Al Green's Love and Happiness. Dun, 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 dun. That's Teeny. So, like I said, the whole Memphis thing was a big family. I explain this by saying we were wonderfully incestuous. Because we worked all over town together. And it competitively, but it was a healthy competition, because it added to the growth and development of the whole Memphis thing. Yeah.
All right, the first song that Sam and Dave and did of David Porter and Isaac Hayes, along with Teeny Hodges, is I Take What I Want. Sam and Dave doing I Take What I Want. My guest today is Isaac Hayes. Well, when you started doing solo albums, you made one kind of a party album, and then you made Hot Buttered Soul, which...
Yeah, my first album was called Presenting Isaac Hayes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't take Al Bell seriously, you know, because he wanted to produce it. I said, sure. Well, there had been a party at Stax, and we had been drinking champagne and eating cake for somebody's birthday. So... At the end of that, I said, right, let me cut some on you. I said, yeah, okay. Went in the studio and cut the tape on and let it roll, man. And I commandeered Duck Dunn, Al Jackson, and I was at piano. Booker came in a little bit and did a little something, I think, but he just let the tape roll, and I just started doing tunes. When I finished, I said, I think I got it, about an hour or something later. And it was called Presenting Isaac Hayes. I didn't think he was going to do it. He said, a couple of weeks later, he said, Ike, you got an appointment at the photographer. For what? For the picture for the album cover. Oh, you serious? So I went out and did that. And it had moderate success. It was hailed by the, critically by the writers, you know, writers for publications and things like that. But I knew I didn't have my best foot for it because I was in an influence of alcohol. So the next opportunity came when Al Bell said, look, we got a big sales meeting next spring, which was in 68. He said, spring of 69, we got a sales meeting. And I want some albums. You have me produce some of these albums on these various artists. I said, okay, I'll help you do that. But Al, can I have an album? He said, yeah, you can have it. I said, can I do it like I want to do it? He said, sure, you got carte blanche, whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I cut Hot Buttered Soul.
And how did you have the idea to do the extended tracks? Because that was totally unusual at the time.
Well, one thing about it, since I felt no pressure, it was like 26 albums released, so I didn't think mine mattered. So I was under no pressure, so I did it selfishly. And I could do what I wanted to do. I was given the permission to do that. So I felt like what I had to say could not be said in 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I got those extended cuts.
And it certainly took off right away, my memory of that record. And did that change your life? I mean, here you are, a guy working in the studio, doing the writing, but very much behind the scenes. It must have really changed things for you.
Oh, it did. It did. I mean, I was thrust out in the forefront. And, you know, I've been performing, but not on that scale. And I had to go through that whole nervous area and all that stuff, man. It was, but, and they supported me too. So, I mean, it was a big deal, a big deal.
You know, that period of time, Isaac Hayes was one of the biggest things in pop culture in this country. I mean, your figure used on your album covers, taking back chains in a way, if you know what I mean. You
mm-hmm.
you wore them in a completely different way. It was a symbol that I think stretched into certainly all branches of black culture, and I think through the culture in and of itself. Were you very conscious of how you were portraying yourself at that time?
Yeah, I was. You know, I was always on the cutting edge. And I was always go where other people feared to go. And I put the chains on because the chains represented power. And once chains represented captivity and slavery for a black man in this country, it represented power. And some took it even further than that, so it was sexy. I didn't do it for that. But it symbolized power, that's why I did that.
Hmm. You also, of course, you know, anytime you appear anywhere, the orchestra is going to play the theme from Shaft. And that was, of course, a huge, huge record and backing up a huge movie. Did you get the idea at that time that you wanted to do acting yourself, or was that a...
I did. I wanted to act then. I'd always wanted to act because in high school, I was a member of the Speakers and Writers Club. I was vice president of that. But, you know, I never thought I'd get a chance to act. But when the Shaft thing came up, you know, I said, hey, man, have y'all cast it yet? I'm going to try for the lead role. I said, okay, Ms. Hayes, we'll do that. But you remember, you got to do the music. Okay. A couple of weeks later, it passed. And nobody contacted me. And I had to come back home to Memphis, you know, tell you, hey, man, give me a shot at the role, man. And then the guy said, hey, Ike, man, you got that call yet? No. Okay, so I called him up and said, oh, Ms. Hayes, yeah, I'm heard. They've already casted a guy by the name of Richard Roundtree. I said, oh, shoot. Oh, but remember, you got to do the music. Yeah, 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 I do the music. Best thing ever happened to me.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Shaft! Right on. You see, this cat Shaft is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Shaft?
In the mid-70s, you and Stax parted ways. How was that resolved, that situation, or has it been?
Well, you know, some of the same people, you know, are here. But, you know, as time passes, you don't labor on sour grapes. I mean, time moves on, and let bygones be bygones.
Isaac Hayes recorded in 2003. He died in 2008. Coming up, more of the main players at Stax Records in the 60s. In fact, we have half of the house band, Booker T and the MGs, with Booker and Steve Cropper, my guests, on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. Our Memphis show continues on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. Another of the important figures in the history of soul music at Stax Studio in Memphis was Steve Cropper. He was the guitarist for the studio band that evolved into Booker T and the MGs, and also was a talent scout and songwriter. We'll hear today about his long association with Otis Redding. When I talked with Steve Cropper in 2005, I asked him what his family thought when it became apparent that the young Steve was going to be a professional musician.
My parents were very supportive of me, the band. My dad, we got off from work, go to a gig, he'd help load the drums and all that. They were totally supportive of that. They never went negative on me about any of that, about, well, you're not going to make it, or you don't have a chance of doing this, and if you do, you're not going to be anybody. But they were very supportive. I think that was a big plus, and it helped. And I just moved right along. I was very fortunate. I started getting serious about it when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote some songs. I had a little instrumental that I wrote. And I got a buddy of mine in school who actually read music to notate it. And I was over at his house one day, and his dad, B.B. Cunningham, came home, and he worked for Sam Phillips at Sun Records. And he said, hey, what's that? And he said, oh, it's a little thing that Steve wrote, and I'm making a lead sheet for him. He's going to copyright this song. He said, hey, that's pretty neat little melody. He said, you mind if I put that on recorders? And he took it to a guy named Bill Justice. And Bill had just come off of, what, 2 number one records in the nation, was big on Dick Clark and all that. And he loved it, and he recorded it, brought me down to sign the contracts on it on a Saturday with my dad. I was 15 years old. And I got my first royalty check when I was 16 years old. It's like hitting the lottery. So, I mean, it was a small check. I wish I'd saved it, but it was a small check. But to me, it was like it could have been, you know, the biggest check in the world. And I went, that's what I want to do the rest of my life. So
now,
I tried.
Were you still in high school when the Marquis had Last Date, which was 61?
We had already graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a little older than we think. we graduated in 59, and Last Night with the Marquis was 61. So we'd been out there trying to hit it pretty good and been on the road. And so we had that record. It was number 3 in the nation, I think, on Billboard.
Ooh.
Our guest is Steve Cropper here on the World Cafe today, and that's, well, as we've just heard, not Steve's first recorded song, certainly, but the first big hit for the Marquees, and that was last night.
How about that sustaining note? Isn't that incredible? Get paid for one note.
Well, about that time was when, as people keep describing it, Jim Stewart kind of gave you the keys to Stax Studios. And I think what people may not understand is how much of a mom-and-pop business Stax was in those days. Is that a good way to describe it?
That's a good way to describe it. And I think the reason I was brought in is just basically I was honest. And I was somebody that Jim Stewart and Estelle both could trust. Estelle actually put me to work selling records up in the record shop, Satellite Record Shop. And, of course, she owed me a favor because I put her son in our band. We had a pretty good little band working around town with no horns, and he came to me one day at school and said, I want to be in your band. And I said, we're not looking for any new members. What do you do? And he said, I play saxophone. I went, well, we're not really looking for horns. I said, how long you been playing? He said, oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months. Oh, boy, this is good. And somewhere in a conversation, he said that his uncle and his mother owned a recording studio. And I said, what are you doing Saturday morning? So we had Packy, Charles Axton. His nickname was Packy. And Packy showed up for rehearsal, and, God, he was screeching. But you know what? It was music to our ears because every Sunday, we used to go out to the studio that his uncle had and his mother, and we would play. And, of course, his uncle thought we didn't have a chance in a hailstorm. We'd never make it.
Well, I'd like to play a couple things, including, of course, one of your most famous co-writes, which is the one with Otis Redding on Dock of the Bay. And maybe if you could just lead us through a little bit of this. I mean, there's some incredible guitar playing on this. It just kind of sets the whole tone of the song. And what kind of a co-write was it? How did it work out?
Well, let me just start by saying that Otis never got to hear the final version of this song.
Right.
It's very sad and unfortunate. He called me from the airport so excited and wanted to know that I was in the studio. Otherwise, he would have gone on to the hotel. I knew he was coming in, but he starts showing me this thing. I left my home in Georgia. So, man, this is it. So, We sat there. I think it probably took me about maybe 20 minutes to put it together, and I wrote the bridge with him. Looks like nothing's going to change. Everything remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same, y'all. And he said, that's it, man, that's it. So we went in the next day and recorded that song. Mm. And he wants the seagull sounds. He's going, caw, caw, caw. And I said, that sounds like a crow. That doesn't sound like a seagull. And I had a little, for all those people out there, listen. He says, I watch the ships come in, and then I watch them roll away again. And I said, Otis, I said, ships don't roll. If they roll, they'll sink. He said, no, Crop, that's the way I want it. I want it. I want them rolling in. And it took me years to figure out. He was talking about the ferries. He was talking about the way the ferries come in. You know how they dock and they roll the water in as they dock so the cars and people can get off? That's what he was talking about. At the time we recorded it, I still disagreed with him about watching ships roll, but anyway. And like I said, he didn't get to hear the final product, but I know he's still up there listening and very proud of it. And God bless Otis, wherever you are, my man.
It's 2,000 miles I roam just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Late Otis Redding, Dock of the Bay. Steve Cropper is our guest. Steve, we're going to let you head off, but I just I wanted to set something straight because I was a little curious myself of some things I was reading about. Obviously, Booker T and the MGs' first big hit was Green Onions. Well, first of all, people have made a point about how quietly important it was that Booker T and the MGs were, you know, two black guys, two white guys playing together in a band in the early 1960s. Did that feel important to you guys? Did it feel unusual at all to you guys?
The funny thing is we didn't know that. That's not what we saw. As far as I know, the whole time I was at Stax Records, there was absolutely zero color. Everybody came in there equal through those doors, and it literally was like going to church every day. Or, you know the feeling when you go to grandma's house? You just feel like, as a kid, you go to grandma's house, you're so safe, you know you're going to get a good meal, you know you're going to get tucked in and a great place to sleep and all that. So walking through those doors at Stax Records was that feeling. It was like going to church every Sunday. You felt this camaraderie of safeness, and everybody was there for the same purpose, and everybody was helping everybody out.
Well, that's an important point. But the point I wanted to clarify was about Green Onions. I've heard two things. One, that it was a jam to begin with, and number two, that it was recorded after you guys had done a jam, and I didn't know which one of those was true.
Second part probably more the truth, because we had just jammed on the flip side of that record. Called Behave Yourself. We were waiting on an artist to record with. Billy Lee Riley was his name. And he didn't show. And so we were jamming on some blues. So Jim Stewart had the tape ready to go and all that, so he just pushes the recording button. We had no idea he was recording. So he said, "Hey, guys, come and hear this." And we go, "What?" So he plays it, and we go, "That's pretty good." And he said, "Well, if you guys got anything you could, if we put this out, is there anything you could put on the B-side?" And we all sort of looked dumbfounded. We're going, is Jim Stewart serious or what? Well, we guess he was. So we all looked dumbfounded. I didn't have anything. And it just came to mind. I said, "Booker," I said, "you remember that riff you played me a couple of weeks ago?" And went, he said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." So he goes out on the organ and he starts playing this riff. And two cuts later, we have Green Onions that you know about today.
That interview with Steve Cropper was recorded in 2005. In 2009, I got a chance to talk with the man himself, Booker T, about that hit and about working at Stax Records in Memphis. To begin, I asked Booker T if he concentrated on playing the Hammond B3 organ because of Green Onions.
I ended up being known as an organist because that was my first hit record. I didn't actually concentrate on the organ. I might have found my best musical voice with the organ, though.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. We had a chance to talk with Steve Cropper about the days working with the Stewarts and working at Stax.
Yeah.
And it just sounds like a wonderful creative environment.
It was.
And what were your various roles that you did? Did you actually lead the band? I mean, obviously it's Booker T and the MGs, but I'm wondering how that worked.
I had a lot of different roles. I was the only one that could write music, so I did the lead sheets for the publishing company. Very often I did the charts when necessary. And they used me as... I might have ended up playing tuba or trombone or tambourine. I ended up moving around the studio on a lot of different instruments because I enjoyed it and because I could. I played harmonica and I played a little bit of guitar and piano.
My understanding is while you were doing that, you went to school and got a music education degree at the same time?
Yeah, a lot of driving between Indiana and Tennessee. Uh-huh.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, now I'm curious about your parents because they seemed to instill a whole lot in you from an early age, and
yeah,
about your musical education in Memphis, because you had to learn how to play Barry early on and all these instruments. Was there a lot of music in the schools?
My parents made it possible. My dad was the patient guy that drove me to the clubs at night, drove me to the gigs out in the country over in Arkansas, and paid for the clarinet, carried all the instruments in his trunk, and my mother gave me the musical soul the inspiration. She provided the example on the piano. She played Chopin, Liszt, Prokofiev, and she played gospel music, and they made it all possible.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So there was a piano in the house?
There was a piano in the house, my grandmother's piano. Uh-huh.
And what was it like first time you switched over to playing an organ? Because it's a completely different hand technique, isn't it?
My piano teacher had an organ in her dining room. And I took piano lessons for a long time before I realized that that wooden cabinet in the dining room was not a break front with china in it, because she had the top down, so I couldn't see the keys. When I finally asked what it was, she opened it up and played a few notes and told me this was a Hammond organ, and that's when I just became smitten with that thing.
Now, when you left the MGs and actually, you left Memphis. You ended up moving to Southern California.
Yeah.
And you did a lot of production work. What were some of the, I know you did Bill Withers. Did you concentrate on production work, or did you want to work as a sideman, or how did that?
Well, it was an uncomfortable situation. I left Memphis, and I basically needed a job when I came to California, and I met Leon Russell, and I met Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss, and I basically needed work. So I started working as an arranger out there, and I met Quincy Jones, and he showed me some of the ropes and showed me around Hollywood some, and then I started producing out there.
And making solo records.
And making solo records, uh-huh, yeah.
And then principal. Records with Priscilla, who was then mm-hmm. your wife.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And had a whole career going. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a story I heard from T-Bone Burnett, who you worked with on the Bruce Coburn, a couple of his albums, that he had your business card from selling real estate on his mantle.
Yeah,
you were doing that to supplement for a while, or
In the early 80s, when the interest rates went up to 23-24% in the United States, the music business just fell apart. It just, the record companies had spent all their money, and there was just no money in music, and I couldn't pay my bills. So I got a real estate license, and I started selling real estate in Southern California.
Did people realize who was selling their house?
Yeah, they did. A lot of them, some of them did,
That's funny. I'm realizing I was just looking at the at dates because Green Onions is a song that has always been part of my musical life, and I really wasn't sure when it came out.
Yeah,
but so it came out in '62.
Yeah, it came out in the late spring of '62. Uh huh.
And what was the story? It was a B-side. It was.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was supposed to be a B-side. Uh huh. For Behave Yourself, which was the A side. That was a blues that we were playing on organ, and we needed something for the B side. And Green Onions is the little riff that I'd been playing on piano that I ended up playing on a little organ just to fill in the record, just to fill out the the other side.
Well, so let's see. So 62, so you were 18.
Just about 18.
Wow.
I turned 18 in November that year.
And do you remember what happened with it? Do you remember how it grew, how it grew as a record?
I took off. I started getting ready to go to Indiana University. I didn't pay too much attention to it. I really liked the way it sounded, but I was focused on being a freshman at Indiana at the time and getting money together for the tuition and clothes and driving up there, and that was my focus right then.
You've been playing this song for a long time. Could we get one more out of you?
I don't get tired of it.
Really?
Not that one. Yeah.
a live World Cafe version of Booker T's signature song, Green Onions. How many times has he played that since 1962? That version was recorded in our studio in 2009. There were at least two other famous studios in Memphis, Ardent and Royal Sound Studios, where High Records recorded in the 60s and 70s. That label's success had to do primarily with producer Willie Mitchell and one extraordinary singer. We'll talk with him as our Memphis special continues. Al Green is my guest when we return to this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe. Our next guest on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe, Al Green, had an extraordinary string of hits in the 70s. Let's Stay Together, Tired of Being Alone, I'm Still in Love with You, a remake of The Temptations' Can't Get Next to You, and countless others. These hits were recorded in conjunction with producer Willie Mitchell, who Green worked with at the beginning of his career and then later on. Green's life changed in 1974 when, after throwing hot grits on the singer, his girlfriend committed suicide. Green points to that incident as a catalyst for changing his life and becoming an ordained minister and only singing gospel. This interview took place around the release of a new album recorded with Willie Mitchell called Everything's Okay. I commented that Al seemed to be singing with the old abandon on this new record.
Well, I mean, I had to get an understanding of what I was doing and the purpose for my life. I was confused because I was a minister, and then again, I was confused because I was singing, Take Me to the River, Wash Me Down, You know, and it was, I was trying to say, well, okay, now, some people say, well, you can't sing that because you're a reverend now, and I'm going like, yeah, but I said, cleanse my soul, put my feet on the ground. And they was kind of like saying, well, I guess ain't nothing wrong with it, but he's an oddball, isn't he? And so I was called an oddball. These people are going like, he's kind of weird, but I guess take me to the river, wash me down, cleanse my soul, put my feet on the ground, do go along with the ideology of the Christian teaching that we're talking about. So, but it's the way he does it. And then he's got those little hips up there, he's shaking and carrying on. And some of the women said, I tell you. And so the men would say, and so the woman would have to calm down. And, yeah, I like that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's all about the falsetto, huh? It's all about the way you sing him, huh?
Well, it's you know, our music is sensual.
Right.
It's kind of sensual. It's you know, I mean, like the people saying yesterday, I mean, you know, like I got three kids, and I know good and well two of them was conceived to your music. And I'm going like, what did you say? And I mean, he says, Al, I mean, the music is, you know, you be with your lady, the fireplace going, you put on, For the Good Times, or How Can You Mend a Broken Heart, or Tired of Being Alone stuff, and I want to hold, take you in my arms and hold, I mean, Al, and he says, I said, skip it. I got it. you just was you. He said, I'm afraid so. So that's one. Well,
you know, you mentioned those songs like Tired of Being Alone, those old ones.
Yeah.
Those recordings and these are so intimate, and I'm curious, yeah, as to how much of those and these new ones come out of your life.
They come right out of the pages of your life. That's why my old lady says, Al, don't tell the people everything. And I'm trying to go like, baby, if you just be quiet, they won't know what I'm talking about. I mean, they don't know that I'm talking about the time that I was talking to you at the bottom of the stairs. But she said, well, just don't be so graphic. I mean, because, I mean, we got to have some type of life. I said, yeah, but I got to write about what's happening now with us today. Because if I don't, I'm writing about something either in the past or something I don't know that's coming in the future. So I'm writing, this is real time. Mm. And so she's saying, like, I love you.
Does it help your performance when you've written something to get into something that you've written? Because you wrote a bunch on this new record. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Willie writes too, and he's so magnetic and getting these changes and this music choreographed and the horns and the violins got to go da 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 da. I'm going like, and you know, as the preacher would say, I said, "Damn, what was that?"
I want to hear. I want to play some of these performances for people. I wanted to do the performance of "Perfect to Me." This is a good one. This is a good one. So
that's a tasty one.
This is Mr. Al Green from Everything's Okay.
Another year has come and gone, but my love for you keeps on.
That's Perfect to Me, one that Al Green certainly gets a hold of on Everything's Okay. And we're talking to the Reverend Al Green today on the cafe. You've brought him up and you've been talking about him a little bit. Can you tell us how you first met Willie Mitchell? You were already singing pop then, weren't you?
Yeah, I was singing pop, but I was kind of like singing everybody's songs because I didn't have any songs of my own yet. Because I hadn't been discovered, really. I had a song called Backup Train that I cut with Palmer James and Ted Mathers in Grand Rapids, because that's why I don't have a southern draw to my accent, because I was raised in Michigan. So I went to Texas. Willie Mitchell was hired for the band, and I'm going to hire this new kid, Al Green, and he's going to come in and sing. Y'all work something out at 3 o'clock, and we'll open the bar at 10, and y'all do your thing. And so when Willie went to the bar after doing a couple tunes with the band, I got up, and he says, well, go over the tunes with him, you know. So they started going over the tunes, and I started to sing. And Willie turned around from the bar and says, man, boy, you got a voice and a half. I'm going like, yeah, right, man. I just want to make the $300. I heard him say that, but I really like didn't believe it. And you know, like if you live in life, you done heard it all before, you know. So you kind of like, yeah, right. But I didn't know I'd be with the guy 35 years later. So you know, that's just the way life worked. Yeah.
Now he helped you discover what Al Green sounded like. Who were you trying to sound like back then?
Oh, man, I was sound like, I'm so tired of being alone. I'm so tired. I was trying to sound like Wilson Pickett, James Brown. I was trying to sound like whoever else was on the market, because I didn't have no Al Green. I didn't know who Al Green was. So Willie Mitchell kept saying, he kept cutting the tape off and running back to the beginning and says, sing like Al Green. And I'm going like, Willie, I really appreciate it, but I don't know how Al Green's supposed to sound. He said, well, we're going to cut until you do. So I got mad. I went outside. I took my Corvette, did donuts in front of the studio, spin my wheels. I left. And I came back about 2.5 hours later, and Willie starts smiling and says, I knew he'd come back. The guy says, sitting by him, so how you know? He says, if he got what I think he's got in him, he'd come back. So I said, hey, man, what about this dang song? He said, don't scream and try to sing something you're not. And so I said, okay. Just knock the song. He says, and I said, I don't want to hear it. Just knock the song on. I said, I'm not going to put no feeling in it. I'm not going to put no emotion in it. I'm just going to sing it dry. And so the song came on, and I said, I'm so in love with you. Whatever you want to do is all right with me. Like that. And Willie Mitchell stopped the tape and said, that's Al Green! And I'm going like, damn, fool, this is hurting my ears.
Well, big kudos to him for making you do that, making you know you had that. You stopped working with him when you made the Bell album. Was that important to you? Did you prove something to yourself in producing that? That record got a lot of people loved that record. It didn't sell as well as some others, but
right. Well, but I had to get out to experience things for myself, to learn things for myself. I had to get some wing space. I had to just kind of, I need to know if I can do this or not. I built my own studio. I started cutting my own music. I couldn't find anybody to play the guitar. So I played the guitar on the whole Bell album because I couldn't, because if you know Memphis is very, very organized, and if you're not a part of the organization, it's going to be hard for you to find a bass player, it's going to be hard for you to find a drummer, it's going to be hard. So me and Ruben is a bass player. Fred Jordan was the studio, he ran the studio. I got another guy, Bill Cantrell from Alabama, who I got to build the studio and put it together for me. And we cut this song, The Lord Will Make a Way, which was our first Grammy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a shock to us. Our eyes was big as Bo Dollars because, I mean, we'd been to the Grammys 5 times and we never won on Sha La La. Michael Nim was winning, and then we went again, and then Lionel Richie Nim was winning, and after that, it was a bunch of other folks. So Willie said, he doesn't going no more. The hell with that. So you know how the old man is. The hell with it. Come on, let's go home. And so I didn't know, so I went and cut this little song, The Lord Make a Way, and won a Grammy, and I'm going like, what? This song didn't even sell as much as Tired of Being Alone, or Nowhere Near Let's Stay Together. And one of the guys at the Grammys, I don't know who this man was standing with his back to us, and he said, maybe somebody trying to tell you something. And I took that very seriously, but he walked off real fast, and I don't know which way he went in the crowd. It could have been an angel. I don't know. But I just heard that, and then I know that Willie and I was made to be together. But I just needed to get out on my own. I was 18 then.
Al Green recorded in 2005, around the time he released the album Everything's Okay, part of his more recent return to working with producer Willie Mitchell. Willie Mitchell passed away in January of 2010. I hope you enjoyed our little trip to Memphis on this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Additional support provided by the members of our World Cafe affiliates nationwide, including WHRV in Norfolk, Virginia, and KRNN in Juneau, Alaska. Shows produced at WXPN from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm David Dye. This is the World Cafe.